Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, March 1st, 2015. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like the show, rate and review it. Give it a 5-star review. Tell everybody why you like it. It makes me feel really good about myself and a majority of the life decisions that I have made. So if you do that, that'll make me feel good, guys. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, Chris Lamberth, on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 108. Last week, for some reason, I didn't tell you what episode it was, even though you knew what it was because it was labeled appropriately, but it just felt weird that I didn't do that. So I'm reminding myself to tell you that this is episode 108. I have a very special guest, Caitlin Bailey, a very funny comedian. She is one of the co-hosts of one of my favorite podcasts, Race Wars, with Kurt Metzger and Sherrod Small. And we're going to get to her in a few minutes, but I just want to talk to you guys for a little bit, and I'll bring you to my conversation with Caitlin. This week was fun. Comedy wise, it started off not as fun because that I was a part of the second show that I was supposed to do in a row was canceled, and I was just feeling a little bummed out. I wanted to work on my craft, and I wasn't able to do that two times in a row. And so Thursday, I got a Facebook message from comedian Gerald Benford, and he hit me up and he said, "Hey man, what are you doing tonight? I got a show at Bergen Community College." I'm like, "Hey, that's Bergen Community College is in Paramus, New Jersey. Really nice campus." I went to the show. It was in a theater at the Chacon Theater, and I did like 25 minutes. The only thing was he didn't tell me I couldn't curse until before my set, and I didn't know. I mean, I'm not like a dirty comic, but I'm not like, "Fucking hey, yeah. If you could see the face that I just made when I did that, glad this is an audio medium. Anyway, so I didn't know, but he said that after my set, so whatever. But it was a fun night. It was fun. And then Friday I did a spot at the Bergen Community College. Really beautiful campus, really nice, and that theater is fucking great. This is a nice theater, a lot of different performances go on there year round. I saw where Ben Vereen is going to be there in May. That's pretty dope. Like Ben Vereen, Broadway actor, horrible father, Will Smith's horrible, estranged father in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. The "Why don't he want me no more?" You know, that episode, shitty dad in Top Five. And I guess he's probably going to do like some singing and dancing and stuff. He was my first high school play. I think he originated the role of the leading player in this show called Pippin. And that was my first high school play. And he was the main guy. Ben Vereen was the leading player. And that was like the character that brought you through the whole show. He comes out and he's like, "Join us, leave your fields to flower. Join us, leave your cheese to sour. Join us, come and waste an hour or two. Ah, doodly-doo, journey, journey to a spotic. So you kind of get, like, he brought out, that was the shit. And I didn't have that part. I played King Charlemagne, and I had not the Charlemagne from The Breakfast Club, but he was Pippin's stepfather, and I had two songs, and it was a good time. It was high school theater at its finest, bro. So that's a trip down memory lane for your host. That was a lot of fun. And back to 2015, where life is a little more complicated for your host. So that was a lot of fun. And Friday I did a show. I talked to Caitlin before my show on Friday, and I went to the Creek in the Cave in Long Island City. I did their show Creek Cave Live. It's produced by Peggy O'Leary and Lindsay hosted. What's Lindsay's? I'm going to get you Lindsay's name, because I'm going to mention people. I'm just going to go through my Twitter, but I think it was Lindsay Bowl. I want to say it was, but I'll just go through to make sure that I've got it right. Okay, hold on. Here we go. Here we go. Lindsay Bowling. Okay. Yeah. Lindsay Bowling was the host, and it was fun. So shout out to Peggy O'Leary and Rebecca Trent. It was fun. I hadn't done a show at the Creek in a long time, and I was working on a short set. So that was perfect to do that, to work there. And so that was that. And then Saturday, I went to a party with civilians, friend's birthday party, buddy from high school. And I'm going to get him on the show. I'm not going to spoil anything, but I'm going to get this guy on the show, and we're going to talk, because he does some really cool shit. And I'm excited to have him on. So did that, talked to some people like an adult. You ever go to somebody's party and it just makes you want to get your life together? It's like, I need to step my game up. I mean, I'm doing all right. As I look at my apartment now, I need to clean it. I need to straighten some shit out. My apartment's nice, but yeah. So I had a great time celebrating my buddy's birthday, and I'll talk about a couple things. I want to say, you know, that group I told you guys about last week, Clear Soul Forces, this Detroit crew, hip hop crew from Detroit. They released an EP yesterday called the Cheat Codes EP, and I put a link to it on my Tumblr page, chrislambert.com, and you can check it out. They got a SoundCloud page, and they got a Bandcamp page and all that. So if you like it, you can buy it. But you can definitely listen to the songs and just check those dudes out, because I slept on them for 3 years. And then thanks to YouTube, they have that section on the website where you can watch. It says watch again or something like that. And I was like, oh, what's this? And I clicked. I was like, oh, yeah, these kids can rap. These guys can rap. I call everybody a kid now. They're probably 25. But now that I'm 35, my birthday was last week, and I didn't even mention it, you guys. My birthday was last week. Thanks to everybody that hit me up on Facebook and Twitter. It was really nice. I didn't really do anything. I mean, it snowed on last Saturday, so I just kind of, what did I do? I played video games, and so I just basically. And watched movies. I basically regressed back to childhood. And then I think I fell asleep while I was watching The Fault in Our Stars. A teen movie. Oh, shit. Oh, my God. But it was actually pretty good. Like, that movie was pretty good. But it got to a point where it's like, okay, they're really dragging this shit out. And it's just like... all right. And it just kind of got to a point where it's like, okay, can we just end it now? like we get an idea of what's happening, and it's, and they had a segment where they went to the Anne Frank house randomly. So Fault in Our Stars, it's on HBO, and if you want to get sad, you know, check it out. I did, after my show at Bergen Community College, after that show, I was in a place where I didn't know if I was just going to go home and watch the How to Get Away with Murder finale, which, fuck ABC a little bit. I don't know what happened with my DVR, and it didn't record. It didn't record the episode. It was a 2-hour episode. It didn't record. And then there's a part one. So I was like, okay, I'll see it on demand. And then it's not on demand. It's only the first part of it. And they do shit. I hate when they do shit like that. Just let everybody see it on demand. What's so hard about that? And I guess they're going to make people wait. They're going to make people wait for a while. If you don't get stuff on DVR, they make it kind of hard for you, in my opinion. I feel like they do. So I was like, am I going to do that, or am I just going to... the Will Smith movie is out. Focus. I just call, like, the big movies, like, from the movie stars, the Will Smith movie, the Tom Cruise movie, the whatever. And I was like, if I go see this movie, am I going to just fall asleep while I'm in there? And it was playing at 9:45? It's 9:45, which meant that the movie was actually going to come on at 10:15 or something like that. And I was like, you know what? I was like, fuck it. I'm going to go see it. Will Smith, I was excited. And I went, and it was only in IMAX. Now, I didn't really mind that, but that IMAX at the Garden State Mall near where I live, Garden State Plaza, it's fake. It's like the fake IMAX. One of my coworkers calls it Limax, and it's not the real one. Like if you live in the New York area, like suburban, like North Jersey, Rockland County, the only IMAX in this area is the one at the Palisades Mall. Really huge screen, the real deal Holyfield, unless you go into the city. But I think those are the only two. I don't know anywhere else in Jersey or New York or whatever. But anyway, I'm going on a nerd tangent. So I paid $17 for those seats, for that seat. And I enjoyed it. Focus, I'll read you a little blurb. I don't want to tell you too much about it. Hold on, here we go. So this is like a brief little blurb about the movie. A con artist, Will Smith, takes on an inexperienced apprentice in this crime comedy from the filmmaking duo behind Crazy Stupid Love. That's basically it. I'm not telling you anything more. If you like Will Smith and you like Margot Robbie, the Leonardo DiCaprio's second wife from The Wolf of Wall Street, then you will enjoy this movie. It's a fun popcorn caper heist movie with a little bit of romance, a little couple of twists and turns. It's a fun movie. I don't like what some of the critics, because I read one review. I think I read like one or two reviews, like after I'd seen the movie. I made the mistake of reading one before, prior to seeing it, because they were giving out plot points. If you're into seeing a movie, if you know you're going to see a movie, just go see it. Don't tell anybody. No, not saying don't tell anybody, but just go see the movie. Don't read anything, especially if you don't want to find. You just go in there blind, not knowing anything. These days, everybody knows. We know too much when we go to the movie. Anyway, I like this movie, and it was just fun. It reminded me of Hitch, because it's a point where he's being a teacher, a little bit of like Ocean's 11, the modern version, Matchstick Men, kind of had that whole vibe to it, but it was just really, it was glossy in a lot of it. Will Smith is just charming as hell, and he's a movie star, but the thing that I like about Will Smith, he's a movie star that can act. Like when he's supposed to look cool and all that, of course he can do it. He's Will Smith. I don't know what was going on with his hair, but his texturizer game, either his texturizer game or his regular hair, he was fucking killing it. Like, I was like, that looks fucking great. It almost rivals, it almost rivals Chris Webber's hair. Chris Webber, what do you call, I just always thought as a kid, Chris Webber had the best haircuts. Chris Webber and Juwan Howard. Chris Webber probably had the best hair. Juwan Howard had the best shape up ever known to man. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that on the podcast before, but Juwan Howard's shape up was so dope, it had to be carried over into the video game. Like in NBA Live and 2K, nobody's fucking with Juwan Howard's shape up. They're still not fucking. Juwan Howard still has the best shape up in the NBA, and he's retired and he's just sitting on the bench. But Chris Webber was like right there with him, close, but no cigar. So Will Smith, shout out to Will Smith's texturizer or just natural curly hair. It's almost like, do you have to have everything, Will? Do you have to have everything, dude? Really? Really, buddy? It was fun. But he's a movie star that can act. And it's like, when he's supposed to be cool, he's cool. When he takes the fall, when he's low status, he knows how to be low status and really nail the joke that he's supposed to nail. It's not like he's like, oh, this is what the script says. Cause it's almost like in some movies where, you know, you're the lead guy, you know, this happens, you know, it's in the script and this is going to happen because it's in the script. But it's like Will Smith just kind of, I don't know. It's just, he can act. That's basically what it comes down to. He can act and he's really in these situations and he's really, he's just really affected by everything that's going on. And, I don't know. I'll talk to somebody that's seen it, somewhere down the line. But, there was a scene that somebody from Grantland wrote about and they were just trying to say like, I just didn't like what some people were saying. And obviously, it was great to see this movie in fake IMAX, regardless of how fake it was, but it was on a huge screen, the interracial love going on. And I enjoyed that. And of course, there were probably a lot of racist things said about that, but I don't think there were enough sex scenes in it. I read a little blurb that said that there wasn't enough. And then now you have like stuff coming out where they said in Hitch he was supposed to be with Cameron Diaz, but they made it Eva Mendez. Eva Mendez is bad, but you know they didn't want Cameron Diaz in it because she was white. Even though her last name is Diaz, but obviously she's white. Anyway, Focus. If you want to see something fun, I think now we're slowly getting it as far as movies go. Movie releases are going. You got like a late February release with a big movie star, and it's a fun movie. And I recommend it. I would say like, for me, it did the job. I would say A. I give it an A. I mean, the movie has its flaws, but I know a guy that gets up for work every day at 4:30. And works really hard and tries to pay his bills. For a 35-year-old dude that works, gets up at 4:30 in the morning, works all day, does comedy at night, and was like, oh, I'm going to see this movie at 10:45. It held my attention. Not whatever 9-10 o'clock at night, I didn't fall asleep. And you know, and I think I admitted that I fell asleep during The Equalizer. And because there were parts when I bought the Blu-ray and I was watching it, and I was like, oh, shit, I don't remember that. I don't remember him killing a guy like that. So I really enjoyed it. All right. So, I'm going to bring you to Caitlin Bailey. Caitlin is, a really cool lady. I didn't really know too much about her. Just knew she was a comedian and started listening to, the Race Wars podcast. And I liked a lot of her insights that she brought to the table. Cause Kurt Metzger and Sherrod Small, it's a terrific podcast, and they're the anchors of the show, but they're these personalities. They're big. These guys are big personalities, and Caitlin comes in there and she drops some gems, and then, you know, they also give her shit and everything too, but it's a really good podcast, and they got a good, rapport with each other. So I knew her from that, and I briefly met her at a show last summer, and I was hanging out at the Stand Sunday, and she walked in, and I was like, hey, I'm Chris. I mean, we may have met briefly, but I love your show. And we talked. She said, oh, I'd like to do your show. And then I was like, I'm gonna hold you to that, and I'm gonna have you on this fucking thing. And we made it happen, and we had a really good conversation. We had a lot of made a lot of references to the TV show Parenthood, and it was fun. And so I had a great conversation with Caitlin, and here is evidence of that. This is me talking to comedian and fellow podcaster Caitlin Bailey. Okay. That's not going to mess up anything, right? You're pausing Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, my whole life is pretty much ruined. I mean, that's like the level of dedication that I have okay. to your podcast is that I'm willing to ruin, like, not just my week or my day, but like my whole life. No, nothing. Everything okay. is fine.
I'm surprised you're not watching House of Cards.
I finished it.
Are you already?
I the whole thing. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I finished all of
it.
All
just
of
House came of out.
House of Cards?
Yeah.
The one about the guy that wants is in politics?
Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
Already?
Yeah, the whole thing.
Didn't it just come out, or did you get the leak? Did you, when they leaked it out by
No,
accident?
I watched it, I went home, this was a while ago, I went home for a period of time that, like, wasn't a holiday, so uh-huh. I had, like, hours and hours and hours of, like, parents at work, and okay. I have nothing to do, because I'm at home, and I become a child when I go home, well, so.
Everybody does that.
Right, yeah, so I just, I, you know, I'd wake up, and just, my whole day was structured around episodes of House of Cards, so I just binge-watched, like, the whole thing.
You know they released season 3 today.
Wait. Maybe I just saw, I got to the point, he was elected vice president, and then the series ended, right?
No, they just put out...
Oh, shit, it kept going? Oh, man, oh, no. Shit, I thought, in my head, I was like, it's over. It's totally over.
Wait a minute.
The thing I'm waiting on is Game of Thrones. That's okay. what I am, like, on the...
I've never seen an episode.
Really? I'm so satisfied with him just getting elected president, and then us calling it... Yeah. Or not elected, but him, like, maneuvering himself into president and that being the end of the series. That makes me so happy.
I tapped out after they killed the white girl that I liked.
You went and throwed her in front of a train?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a really hard moment
it's
for me.
It's Kate Mara. He just pushed. I was like, what the fuck? I'm done.
Yeah. I mean, she was great.
Yeah.
But then the whole concern, I love that that's, like, I feel like that becomes his... weakness, like that whole story and that okay. network of people that are sort of into it, and that weird computer guy who is like the gerbil analogy. Did you watch the series or not?
Saw the first season and then that was it, and I don't really remember, like, I honestly don't remember much. Okay. So I'll probably have to start over.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like that's the only thing to do.
See, so no wonder you've got Parenthood on.
I have Parenthood, which is like it's mom porn for me, because me and my mom are going through a rough patch, and so this is like, it's like, I feel like it captures a lot of the emotional truth of our relationship, but what we don't have are the, like, brilliant reconciliation moments where suddenly the mom yeah. walks in like a superhero and just knows how to make everything better, like by magic.
The Bravermans, they have the power to everything turns out right.
Everybody in that family, including the kid with Asperger's, is so emotionally intelligent. Like just the
you think he's emotionally intelligent?
I think he's a literary device, you know, in that yeah. like he becomes the truth sayer in the family. He's the one that everyone else, if everyone else is being held back because of social mores, not to say a hard thing, he's the kid that jumps in there and is like, oh, here's the obviously true, but impossible thing to articulate.
I thought for the longest time that...
I mean, he's not actually emotionally intelligent. That's what Asperger's is that he can't read people.
My listeners know that I worked with kids that had Asperger's. Mm-hmm. I was a TA... in a special ed room, and then I taught theater camp in the summers when I lived in Chicago, and we had kids, but they were just like, the kids in the summer camp were just mild, had the mild touch of the autism.
Sure.
What do you call it? They just had Asperger's.
Yeah.
Like some kind of...
Like comics. Some yeah, okay, I get it.
But I think now, like, it's kind of been the hip and trendy thing to say, oh, maybe I have a little Asperger's. Oh, no, you're just an asshole.
There have been episodes where I'm like how upset he gets at something that is unsolvable and also not that big a deal. Maybe I have Asperger's. Yeah, but maybe I'm just a cunt. Like, I mean, I'm willing to accept that.
I would say there was a long stretch where, I don't know if you're a fan of Breaking Bad, if you ever watched it.
Yes, I finished that one. That one I know ended because...
Yeah. So there was... there was Gus Fring
as
the worst, the most evil TV villain, one of them.
Okay, all right.
And then there was Max Braverman right behind him.
What?
That's how I felt. That was like a running gag between me and people that used to watch, like, live
TV. That's hilarious.
Because he was an asshole for quite some time.
Yeah, of course he was.
But not because of the Asperger's. I think just because
he was a manipulative, like... person.
He was kind of a jerk.
He lacks basic empathy. That's like part of the thing. Yeah. I mean.
And then the kid. What's the other kid?
They just adopted.
The adopted kid.
Oh, yeah.
He was a douche for a while.
Well, he just started baseball. I'm on like season...
Oh, shit. I'm not good. What season are you on?
I'm on season 4. Oh, but I mean, you know he's going to be a nightmare. Like, after all that just like you knew she was never going to get that baby. Like, that was never... That,
all the kids are jerks on the younger kids are jerks.
Really, even what's his face? The musical geniuses kid, the half black guy, where they were like, they get married.
He's a bit of a whiner, but he's everybody except Jabbar.
The thing with Jabbar is that I feel like he is way too cognizant of his own needs. Like, he just walks up to his dad and is... Or, like, even dealing with Max, where he's like, I don't want to eat lunch with you. It's, like, just that simple. He's just a simple stater of, like, what I need is this. And I'm like, I don't have the basic self-knowledge or sense of self to advocate for myself as strongly as Jabbar does in this series. Like, you ask him a question, he's confident that, like, he has all the information he needs to be like, I would like pineapple on my pizza. End of discussion. It's not a power move. There's no other motivation.
Right, he's a kid.
He's just a kid. He's like, I need... Bah! And that the one emotional breakdown he has was with the cleaning his room thing. And that's it. That's the only time that kid throws a fit about absolutely anything.
A normal 7-year-old.
Right. Probably. Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't want to clean my room. I'm like, I get it. I didn't want to, but you motivated me to clean my room today. So, you know.
It's a good show. I mean, it's the creators of Friday Night Lights. So
it's great.
I was a big fan. I was kind of, maybe you and I will have to talk about it when you're done. Mm-hmm. I guess when you finish, what did they do, 6?
I don't know. I'm on season 4 right now.
You'll probably, because the last season just ended, so you'll probably have to watch it on Hulu or something.
Wait. Is it over then?
It's over.
Oh,
over.
Good.
Yeah.
Here's my new thing. Game of Thrones only reaffirmed a basic impulse of mine, which is to try not to, if I'd known House of Cards wasn't over, then this would be different, but I try not to start series until they're over.
Yeah.
Because I get myself like in a Game of Thrones situation where I got sucked into Game of Thrones and they just took that fucking candy dish away from me.
Do you know Leah Bonema?
Yes.
I can't get her to... She's the same way.
Right.
She will...
When it's over, I will sit down and I will watch the entire thing. I will lose 4 days out of my life and not shower and just smoke pot and binge watch. I will just... I'll consume it all in one continuous segment because I can't not click next episode.
I'm the same way, but I got two coworkers mad at me because of Orphan Black. Now, I mean, the BBC series about the clones.
Yeah, no, I don't watch that. I'm sure it's beautifully executed.
It's good. I mean, towards the end of the second season, they were kind of feeling themselves a little bit. They're like, oh, we know we're popular now. And it's kind of like, just kind of fall back and just deliver the shows. Don't try to be so self-aware. But it's a solid show.
Mm-hmm.
John Moses, do you know John Moses?
I do, yeah.
He made a Facebook post a couple days ago. He said, oh, you know, dear Canada, Orphan Black is shit. Your son, John Moses, and I almost unfollowed him.
Oh.
But it's a good show, but I think when I found out about it, I said, let me see what all this hype is about. So I watched the first couple episodes within a 4-day period or something like that, 10 mm-hmm. episodes or something. And then I told a coworker about it, and he said, man, when you told me about that show, I didn't do anything for the whole weekend.
I know, yeah, no, it's ridiculous. Like, I feel like that's what happens as well. And so I really have to be convinced, because what you're basically asking me to do when someone's like, hey, you should get into this TV show, is like, you should have all the symptoms of depression for weeks at a time.
Really?
It's ridiculous. I don't exercise. I don't shower. I cancel plans.
Spots?
I don't cancel spots. Okay. I draw the line there. I have, and this is a low point for me, rearranged a work shift because I just couldn't.
What do you do?
I was a waitress at the time that I did this. So it wasn't a big deal. I called a girlfriend of mine and was like, hey, can you cover my shift? Like, it wasn't hard for me to do that.
Really?
Like, I didn't disappoint. I didn't, like, not show up to my fancy office job. Like, I just, you know, had somebody else bring people eggs in order to... Because it wasn't worth the shift pay for me. Like, I felt like I knew how much money I was going to make. And mm-hmm. I was like, is it worth that to not...
I've ever done that. I mean, I would say, like...
It's a super cunty thing to do. Like, I mean, it's not a high point for me.
I think you're the first woman who's done this podcast to ever say cunty.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize.
You can curse. Oh, you can do whatever you want. But it's just interesting. And I think you're one of few women that I've had on the show that has her own place.
Oh, yeah. I mean...
You and Phoebe Robinson.
This was a miracle. I was homeless for the 3 months leading up to this, and I didn't know I was going to get this place until like January 28th or something, and moved in February 1st. So what happened, I went through a string of nonsense places. I've been in New York for 3.5 years. So my first place, I shared a studio with a woman and her dog.
You shared a studio?
I know. It's a nightmare. And had lived there by herself for 10 years and just needed the money and like brought me in. So it was like super uncomfortable because I was in her space. So she'd come home and would be like, did you move this porcelain doll 2 inches to the left? I'm like, I don't think so. Like, I didn't walk over to your side of the room and like move things over. But I don't know. And she had a dog, so everything that I owned was covered in dog hair. She would record 2 shows at a time, so she like wouldn't even be in the apartment, and I like just couldn't watch
you
what I wanted to watch.
You can't.
Right? Yeah, it was stuff like reruns of Family Guy. It doesn't matter. So I lived with her, and that disintegrated. And then I moved into a flop house. Basically, it was 5 people in a mm-hmm. 2-bedroom apartment, and we were all sleeping on like piles of yoga mats. Like I was on the pull out couch in the living room / kitchen, and everyone else that lived there was 20 years old. Like they weren't old enough to legally drink. There was all like NYU students or wannabe actors, and like it was a nightmare. And then my best friend came to New York mm-hmm. and rescued me for a period of time. And so she makes like adult money. She works for a big thing. She's all over the world. She's in Africa and India and China, and like she works. I don't know what she does.
Not adult money, as in
she makes
Pornhub.
No, not okay. Not adult film gotcha. Star money.
Just but wanted
like,
to make.
Yeah. No, she makes like I'm a responsible adult that has enough money in the bank to solve problems.
Okay,
money.
Gotcha.
And so she came and took one look at my living situation and was like, absolutely not. So she got an apartment and I moved in with her for a period of time. And then I started renting that out on Airbnb. Mm-hmm. During that period of time, I moved in with my boyfriend. Uh-huh. And I hold away all of the profits from that situation mm-hmm. in order to get money for this. So this is my first space. So I'm going to have this, and then renting out the other room on Airbnb, I think okay. will give me... I'm out of money right now. So if that doesn't work out, I'm absolutely fucked because there's no way I can make rent waiting tables here. But Jesus. If I get this up and running, I think that will give me enough financial flexibility to do comedy and not... die in a fire. I don't know what the alternative is, but you know, not you know,
do
not
comedy or die in a fire.
Yeah, I think that's what I said, but I don't know what that means.
Like it's, yeah, I mean, that was kind of. I was like, what?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's. I feel like it's really like, comics can get to a really weird place where it's like it's comedy or death, or like that. That seems to be our decision making process. Like,
yeah, I mean, I love comedy, but I.
But do you love it?
Enough to die.
9-hour drive from Buffalo to Toronto in blizzard conditions where every radio station you turn to is like, go home.
You know, I turned down a gig. I had to cancel a gig that I really wanted to do. That was like a gig in Westminster, Maryland. It was like 3 hours away. And just the weather was really bad. Mm-hmm. And the news anchors were just stay in mm-hmm. your house, stay home, mm-hmm. don't go anywhere. And then my parents weren't because mm-hmm. they care. Mm-hmm. And it's like, they're like, you're going to fucking die. Mm-hmm. And it's, I'm like, no, I can't. I'm yeah. not going anywhere.
Well, first of all, pussy.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. Yeah, but second of all, yeah, that makes sense. I've lied to my parents many times. It's like, I've been like at a gas station or something in blizzard conditions and I'm just like in the bathroom like, yeah, no, you're right. That total. I gotta go, but no, I'm gonna take a nap, or I'm gonna turn my phone off. Like I don't know.
How old are you?
I'm 28. I'm almost 30 years old, and I still lie to my parents about my choices regularly. I
mean, sometimes, well, you were mentioning going home when you go home to your parents' house.
Yeah,
you automatically revert into your childlike self.
Not just childlike self, but I feel like the worst version of my childhood
mom.
Self. Exactly. Okay. I'm like, mom, go. I asked for bagels without sesame seeds.
Oh, wow.
I'm the worst, and it's I don't want to get up before 1 o'clock in the afternoon, which I do. Right? I mean, in all fairness to them, my schedule is actually that of a night owl. So
okay,
I don't rearrange my schedule for family activities, which would be the more polite thing to do, and I would do as a guest in anyone else's home is like. Get up when they get up and participate mm-hmm. in whatever.
What's but. That sketch that on SNL, Back Home Ball? What is it, the Back Home Baller?
When that you go sounds home? Amazing. I
you know you haven't seen it. It's like, it's one of those SNL videos where where you go back, when you go back home to visit your parents for the holidays, you're like a baller.
Yeah.
Like your mom does your laundry.
Oh, yeah.
And she's got candy and you got all the crazy stuff. So you're like, living
well,
on top of it all.
My father has done my laundry every time that I go home since I graduated from college because that was our deal.
What was the deal? If you went to school, you would do your laundry?
Graduate college and I'll do your laundry for life forever.
That's it?
Yeah.
You didn't go for anything else?
I mean, they also paid for school, but okay, like, but that was one. That was one of those like sort of, he said it in a joking way and I, because I mean, I was headed to college anyway. It wasn't like a fight. But my dad was like, if you graduate, I'll do your laundry. And I was like, deal, sir. And now, 10 years later, I'm still hoarding. I'm a bad person, basically.
I don't know. Since we were talking parents, let's talk about your origin story. That's what we do on this show.
Oh, sure.
Talk about, so now, currently, we're in your apartment. You're a New Yorker. You're a woman. Living it up in the big city. How did you're scared if you're not going to be able to pay your rent.
Yeah, but that's going to be, I mean...
I think you will, though.
It's a solvable problem.
Like, Airbnb should work out. Do you have to pass some kind of certification?
I've already done that with my last apartment. Okay. So, like, I'm already, I'm all set up to do this. The only thing I have to do, the real obstacle to getting my Airbnb set up is that I have to ask my super for help drilling into the wall, and I know that he doesn't want me to drill into the wall at all. But this building, it's pre-war, it's super old, and so the walls are made out of, like, chalk. So when you drill into them, they just disintegrate in your hand. And I don't know where any of the support beams are, so I really need his help. This dresser right here is something that my super, who is an old man from Mexico City, actually, and he's, like, a super. He's lived in the building for 50 years. He knows every crevice. He runs it like clockwork. Like, he's really invested in this building and loves the owners and, like, has been here for years. He hand-built this for me without my knowledge or consent and custom-built it for this apartment. I hate this piece of furniture. I think it's oppressive. I don't like this particular piece of furniture.
Why do you think it's oppressive?
It's just too tall. It's too big for the space. It's just too big for the space, and it's not like the look that I'm going for. And again, this is my first apartment, and I'm a spoiled brat, and I'm used to having things the way that I want them. Child? I am an only child.
I am too.
So you understand.
I'm
right.
Yeah, but I don't think I'm. I don't think I've been a douche about it.
I'm
not saying that you're being one.
Probably closer. I also grew up rich and the child of two parents that grew up poor and became rich, which is like a different mentality of like, let me give you every opportunity
that I didn't have. Well, I had that with my dad, but they were working. My parents were middle class.
Okay.
Like, basically, most of the toys that I wanted, I got.
Yes. Yeah,
but
absolutely.
But it would be like, oh, if you got a good report card, you get this.
They had a very similar system in retrospect.
Yeah, I wasn't like...
With one glaring exception.
What's that?
My parents rewarded me for totaling my first car that I bought myself with a convertible that they bought for me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
I want to finish the wardrobe.
Let's finish the wardrobe.
All right. So the movers were here. My mom was here. Things were a nightmare between my mother and I. We hadn't eaten. We were tired. We were at each other's throats. 28 years of emotional, like, bullshit was between us. And I'm in the middle of an incredibly stressful move.
Mm-hmm.
So the movers are here. My mother wants me to keep this piece of furniture because she wants me to keep it. It's not, and now it becomes a power game, right? Because it's not her apartment, it's my apartment. Mm-hmm. Whose apartment is it? It's mine. I don't want it.
Sure.
So I'm in that place. So I tell the movers to break this piece of furniture down and get it out of here. Because I have waiting for me in an attic in New Jersey that I'm sending the movers to an antique wardrobe that is smaller than this that will fit better into the space that will do everything that this does that I needed to do. Okay. And it's beautiful cherry wood, like antique. It's been in this attic and I was told that I could have it. So I sent the movers to Elizabeth, New Jersey to pick up that piece of furniture and told them to dump this at the end of the day.
But what if your super comes and he's like,
that's exactly what happened. So before they get to New Jersey, my super comes down because we're in the process of borrowing like ladders and drills and da-da-da-da-da. So he comes down and is like, where is this thing? And I'm like, I took it away. The man teared up, okay?
Oh, shit.
Teared up and is like, I built this for you. It's good wood. If the da-da-da-da-da-da. And I immediately understand that I have fucked up, like, royally. Yeah. The second phone call I get, so he comes down and we have that moment, and I'm like, I'm sorry, it's gone. And then my movers call me and tell me they can't get the antique wardrobe out of the attic. Cannot be done.
Is this at some random house somewhere?
No, it's at my aunt's house.
Oh, you're
but,
on the
but it's in the attic. Okay. Yeah. And so they're trying. They cannot get it down. And I'm not there. So like they tell me they can't do it.
So you're supposed to have this,
right? So, well, no, that's not how I'm looking at it.
Okay. All right.
It's fine.
I'm
eventually getting rid of this piece of furniture. That's decided. We're not going to repeat this. It's my fucking apartment, okay?
Christina Braverman would accept that it has to be in her life. One of the Bravermans would look at this as not as an impediment, but a stepping stone or something like that.
You're wrong about everything. So now the movers come back. We're in the middle of putting IKEA furniture together.
Okay.
And the movers come back, and they have not thrown this away, but it's in pieces. Okay?
Oh.
So they bring it back, and we, on a not level surface, because we've got the carpet, and IKEA furniture is being built, like, around me. Like, it's just all these moving parts. Everything's fucking chaos. And we rebuilt it, and it looks like dog shit. Like, there's a big hole there. It's covered in footprints. All of these were torn off and re-screwed. All the screws were stripped. We had to, like, dig into the wood. It's not level. These doors will never shut again. Like, this is just how it is for the rest of eternity. And so, before I call my super and ask him for help drilling into the walls he doesn't want me to drill into, I have to get up the courage to tell him that I rebuilt his wardrobe shoddily and that I suck as a person. So that's what I'm not looking forward to.
That has web series written all over it.
What? That's not...
It does.
I don't... Yeah, maybe. I mean... He's amazing, and I love his dog, Benji, mm-hmm. and he's so sweet and so well-meaning, but...
That's a story. I mean, that's a long bit.
It's going to keep going because I do eventually need to hang these things, so I have to get that done somehow.
But I love what you've done with this place.
Thank you. It's not near complete. Like, this is leaving... I don't know how I feel about this anymore. I definitely want to change the knobs and get some art hung. And I have behind you, I have a screen that I'm hanging in to close this basically window into the kitchen.
Okay.
But I like the setup. I think this is going to be a great bedroom. I think that's going to be a good, like, rental situation. I love my back porch.
You can hang out back there.
Yeah.
Crawl out there.
Smoke cigarettes. And the other day, my super caught me in cowboy boots without socks. It was like 10 degrees outside. Cowboy boots without socks, a bathrobe, and my winter coat over my bathrobe, but my bathrobe like sticking out
like
with hair.
People.
Right? Just 4 o'clock in the afternoon, smoking a cigarette, watching Parenthood, bawling, snot bubble tears, just streaming down my face, chain smoking at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I looked like a crazy person.
Which scene? What happened?
Well, oh God, hold on. What was it? It was a mother-daughter scene, and it was the, between the
Gilmore
woman.
Girls lady. Lauren,
yeah.
Lauren Graham.
Yeah. It was between Lauren Graham and her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I live with these people. I can't remember their names. Yeah.
I hate, you know what? Like, I'm eventually going to see that movie, but it's
the
like...
The Duff? I don't know.
It's called... What is The Duff? It's called Ugly... D-something Ugly Fat Friend. It's like... A Duff is like... If you hang out with somebody that's super less hotter than you,
mm-hmm.
to make yourself look even better.
That's not how that works, though, psychologically. People group things together. So if you want to be super attractive, you hang out with other attractive people, and people will look at you and be like, that's a group of attractive people.
But that's the premise to that, show.
Well, people that do that are dumb.
So it's like... But you know, it's the girl that's kind of like the
I get it.
You know that girl. She's not... I think she's attractive.
But she's TV that girl. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I mean, if we met her in real life, that's an, like, unequivocally hot chick.
Yeah.
But you see that chick on TV, she could be a supermodel's, you know, puffy friend.
Yeah, like she's, like, yeah. They're supposed to be... Not, and it's, like, the whole fucking she's all that, like...
Yeah.
You need Rachel Lee Cook takes off her glasses, and now you realize...
And plucks her eyebrows. Everyone forgets about eyebrow plucking, and
okay.
I can't be... overstated how important
I don't even know about
it's
that.
Like,
but it's like looking at like, oh yeah, she's fat, and I'm like, she's what every black guy would
she's,
hit on.
She's not that. She's not fucking fat.
No,
she's not.
That's what I mean.
She's like, my size.
She's not. Yeah, really.
Yeah. Positive.
You're smaller than her.
No.
Really?
I look smaller than her because she hangs out with super skinny TV people on the show. So you just see her next to, like, the Hades of the world. Heidi, what's her name? The other...
Maddie?
Yeah, Maddie. You hang out with Haiti. I'm the worst.
Hattie.
There you go. Haiti. Maddie is Nashville. How funny would it be if her name was Haiti when she was dating that black guy? Or anyway. So her name is Hattie. Is a twig. She's 90 pounds soaking wet. Yeah. So next to her, she looks like a thick girl.
Right,
live in the world, and so I feel like I look smaller.
Because I saw her in Perks of Being a Wallflower, and I was like, oh, she looks... this has been Parenthood Talk.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
Chris,
that's funny.
And Caitlin,
we wanted to do origin story, but and we were talking about getting this set up.
We were talking about the dresser.
What did we want to?
And you said you feel bad. You have not yet told your landlord that.
I have not let him see it yet. He knows that we broke it down.
Uh-huh.
He knows that we brought it back and we rebuilt it. He knows that. He doesn't know how shitty a job I did of rebuilding it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm afraid to break this old man's heart before I ask him to drill into the walls.
Ah. Well, you gotta, I don't think it'll be as bad as you think.
Everyone keeps saying that. But nobody else saw his face when he heard that I took this out of the apartment.
Well, I said it before you could even get it out that you probably broke his heart.
I did break his heart. I broke his heart. I broke a hardworking old man's heart who loves this apartment building more than I could ever know, because I am a woman in her 20s who just moved here. So, yeah.
Well, I want to talk about you growing up. You said, so you're you're a product of having parents that used to be...
Yes.
Poor, and then super they came poor. Into money. What do your parents do?
Well, my father grew
you're
up...
You're from North Carolina, right?
No, not really. No. I come from a military family.
Okay.
So the first 10 years of my life, we moved every 2 years. But my father is from rural Kansas.
Okay.
His father was born in the late 1890s, served in World War I, and he didn't have my father until he was in his 60s or
70s. Wow, I was going to ask. Okay.
Yeah. And he married a woman 25 years his junior. Actually, I don't know if they ever got married. Whatever. He was a bootlegger. So they were super rich for the first 5 years of my father's life.
Mm-hmm.
And then him and his father and mother were arrested one night after a shootout. And my dad spent 6 months in an orphanage, because by that point, they asked like other family members to take my dad and his two sisters, and they wouldn't do it. Presumably because of my grandfather's like substance abuse issues or other personality quirks that come with running an underground business for a long time.
Okay.
But so they clearly alienated family support. So my father spent some time in an orphanage, and then when his mother got out of jail, they suddenly went from having, money enough to tip drivers, to drive kids around and do whatever, to having no money. So she worked in an egg factory where they would hold eggs up against candles to see if they were fertilized, to make sure that people didn't, when they got like a dozen eggs, they didn't crack a chicken or like a little chick into the pan. So that's the mom, that's the job that my grandmother had. So my father...
All in Kansas.
All in Kansas.
Okay.
And then eventually they moved to Colorado when my father was in the seventh grade. He dropped out of the seventh grade just after learning how to read. Starts a street gang or whatever. Hooks up with this girl and is running around until things get bad enough between him and this girl, where he decides to join the army in order to support them. Because I think at that point they were living in a car in Colorado together, and he wanted to support his new bride, so he joined the army at 17.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up having a 30-year career. He was a Green Beret. He flew Apache helicopters. He served two tours in Vietnam, one tour in the Dominican Republic, and one tour in Desert Shield, Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
Seen a lot of action. He retired as a warrant officer four, and now makes more money sitting on his couch than my mom does working her ass off, which my father thinks is the funniest thing that... So, yeah.
What does your mom do?
My mother,
you said she was like an ex-hippie or something?
Kind of. She's really an ex-party girl, but being a party girl in like the 60s and 70s meant like...
Flower.
Yeah, sort of. But my mom grew up the youngest of four in New Jersey, and their father... Cedar Grove.
Where is that at?
It's like near Montclair. It's near New York. It's like so it's right
Union,
over there.
That, is Montclair Union? Is that Union County?
I don't know specifically.
Because I live in Jersey. I live in Bergen County. Okay. So that's like Montclair is like less than half an hour away from me.
Then Cedar Grove is probably right around there. Like, okay. I don't know if it's 35 minutes away or 25 sure. minutes away, but it's like it's somewhere in that region. But she was the youngest of four. Their father was a milkman and also a psychopath. And their mother was a really, really talented but clinically depressed person who marrying a psychopath sort of ruined her. So the four girls really raised themselves.
So was she talented at what?
She was one of the first female computer coders in the U.S.
Like Imitation Game shit?
I don't know what that is.
I haven't seen it. Do you know the movie?
I know. I mean, she wrote code. She was a woman who wrote code in the 50s.
That's gotta be.
You know what I mean? Like, right. And she made all of their own clothes. Like, she made all the girls' clothes. She was very artistic, with home ec stuff. Like, everything was.
But go back to the coding. That's pretty interesting.
I don't know.
Back then, you didn't know.
I don't know more about it. It was like a thing that my mother said in an offhand way. Right after saying, like, yeah, if she could ever get out of bed, then she'd make it happen. But what would happen?
Is she still alive?
No, she's dead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever ask your mom anymore, like, just kind of make her elaborate on it?
Well, my mom and I are not speaking right now. Okay. So no.
Maybe she'll listen to this podcast.
Very unlikely. My mom doesn't know what podcasts are, and that's a better. We should keep things that way. But anyway, so she, at 17, she wasn't a great student. She was into a lot of drugs in, like, high school. And then she went to community college for like a minute and then ran away to California with one of her other sisters and they got jobs out there, you know, bartending. My mother ended up working for Prudential. Prudential asked her if she was open to travel. She said yes. They sent her to Germany. That's where she met my father. My father divorced his first wife and then married my mother.
Oh, so the bride was not your mom, the first bride.
No, okay. The first bride was not my mom. But my mom also didn't break up their marriage. Like, okay. My mother and father knew each other socially beforehand.
Okay.
My father, but they weren't friends. Like, they just knew each other in passing. My father got divorced. Because my mother sold insurance, my father reached out to my mother. Because after a divorce, there's, like, a ton of paperwork shit that has to change. Like, especially a 17-year marriage in the military. Like, there's just a lot of things that have to happen. And so
any kids from that marriage?
No, okay. zero kids. Never mind.
Okay, so reacted.
Well, my father and his first wife got pregnant before they were married. His first wife gave that child up for adoption before my father proposed marriage. Mm. Then they got married and didn't have any kids.
Is there a record of that kid?
Not that I've been able to find.
Or have you tried to look at them?
Not very hard.
Okay.
Like
no, I mean that's honest.
I did like 6 minutes of Googling and was like, this is hard.
Fuck it,
right? Yeah, basically. Yeah, that basically.
May God bless you.
So that, and then that person would be in their 50s. So, because it was a really long time ago. My dad, anyway, it doesn't matter. So, the sequence of events. So my father reached out to my mother to ask, like, divorce questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My mom came over, and that's when they started flirting. That's when.
See, now, I'm thinking of the Parenthood theme song after you were just like.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's like the dichotomy of like, oh my god, this family show. So, did you try to look for your brother or sister?
No, I didn't.
May you stay forever.
I mean, that's one of the weird themes of my family is that my parents have, or my father, I guess both of my parents, they definitely paid a lot of lip service over the years of like how important family is, but. They've also had a long history of different family members being estranged for whatever reason.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, like, my dad didn't talk to his sisters for 20 years. It wasn't until I was born that he talked to his sister and mother again because of something that happened with his first wife, presumably around the adoption situation.
Okay. Yeah.
Don't have the requisite details to make any judgment on that.
Sure.
But anyway, something went sour. My dad was like, fuck these people. And these people included his sisters and mother. Mm-hmm. His father was already dead. And then when he got married to my mom, they were not at the wedding. They did not reconcile. And then when she got pregnant with me, they were like, oh, shit, family. And then I used to do Thanksgiving with my father's family and Thanksgiving with my mother's family. But right around when I was 8 or 9 years old, something else went awry.
And where is this at?
This was in Florida. Okay, we go Florida for my father's family, and then we in North Carolina host Thanksgiving. Before okay. then, we used to travel.
Like, we used to do that too. Like, I think,
but we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I think for my family, when the patriarchs and the matriarchs die, that's when like shit just kind of people show their true colors, and that's sort of what it's been like. It hasn't been like people are fully estranged from each other, but it's been like it's been
less effort. Different.
Yeah,
less effort, less fucks given.
And my mother is the one that we should go back to North Carolina and visit. Nobody really wants to do that.
Right. Yeah. Why would you spend a lot of money to travel to see people that only bring out the worst in you, that irritate you? Like
Yeah, it's sad though.
It is kind of. I mean, watching Parenthood and watching The Braverman, but I mean, that's a nice.
It's super idyllic.
Yeah.
You never see Christina's parents.
Yeah.
You never see them at all.
Yeah.
It's like they just kind of. The Bravermans take over everything.
Yeah, I think the only exception to that is Jabbar's mother's family.
That's it.
But I feel like we only see that as a comparison.
A black woman being a roadblock.
She's not a roadblock. She just believes in Jesus, and white people in Berkeley are like, what? That's so.
Well, it gets
last generation. this other shit happened. You can't tell me, Pat.
I'm not going to tell you. All right. Continue. Okay. So you come into the world.
So, yeah. So they get married and they live in Germany. And then we move to Tacoma, Washington. So I'm born in Washington State.
Wow. What's that like?
We left before my first birthday. So okay, I can't. So you have nursing no idea. Room was probably heated. Probably like, I don't know. Right. Yeah. You know. Rocking chair.
A hemp-made rocking chair.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then we moved to Texas when I was from 1 to 2, and then we moved to Germany when I was 2, and then we're in, like, 3 different towns in Germany. And then when I was 8 or 9, we moved to Fayetteville, North Carolina, and then from Fayetteville...
What's the base down there?
It's Fort Bragg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Highest concentration of Green Berets in the world, so...
My grandfather was stationed down there. I don't know too much about it. I have to ask my dad.
They call it Vietnam. It's, I mean, doing debate stuff there, and I've performed comedy there since then. Like, look, it's strip clubs and car dealerships, like, sort of across the board. Mm-hmm. It's actually sort of sunk lower than the surrounding county, so it's like... legitimately more hot and more heat. It's like more physically miserable in Fayetteville than it is in surrounding counties.
Now, is this where you kind of put your roots down?
No, that happened in Raleigh. So that's Raleigh.
But North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Eight, nine years old.
So 8, 9 Fayetteville, 9, 10 Raleigh. So and that's when I went to.
So you're a North Carolina.
I'm a North Carolina.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Going from Germany to the American South was weird because...
Explain. Like, so talk yeah. a little bit about Germany.
Germany is a country filled with people with Asperger's. It's a very literal, specific, this is the right way to do things kind of thing. And we lived off base. And so we were living in these neighborhoods where the culture is very much like, let me tell you what to do.
Yeah.
And then the American South is all innuendo and people don't really feel comfortable like disciplining other people's kids. And like, our family really didn't fit in. We didn't go to church, and it was a very church school and church neighborhood. And I was raised going to saunas and nudity is like a normal part of the house. So like, that was weird.
Is this when your parents got wealthy?
Yeah, right around that period. So my father retires and he starts working for OSHA, and then he worked in private sector. So it was, and then my mom started being able to really work during this period too. It's really hard on military wives or wives of anyone where their job requires a lot of travel. Husbands too. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I don't mean to be.
No, but you don't have to do that.
Yeah, all right. Well, like, because it's not like my mom couldn't work because she was super busy being a mom. Mm-hmm. She couldn't work because she couldn't invest more than 18 or 24 months into a company before having to move again. And nobody wants to hire somebody to do real things if it's going to be a transient workforce, you
know? What was your mother's specialty? What did she do?
She sold Prudential, and she was great with sales. Uh-huh. Then when we moved to North Carolina, she worked at a bank. She worked as a teacher's assistant. She went through a series of sort of weird odd jobs that weren't a good fit. Uh-huh. And then she went and she finished her degree in design from NC State. She worked as
is that their thing?
Yes, this is their thing. Yeah, okay. They're for Wolfpack. And so then she worked for Ethan Allen for many, many years.
Sold furniture
as an interior designer. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And now she just
isn't that the Raleigh's the furniture capital of the world, right?
North Carolina is. We build a lot of furniture in Henderson and Hillsboro area, but we sell a lot of it in Raleigh.
Because my mom. She is into that.
Oh, sweet.
That shit she loves. And that's where she would get all of her furniture.
That's great.
Yeah.
So that's sort of where they're at. And now my mom just quit Ethan Allen and started her own. She's a freelance interior designer now.
Is that maybe the crux or the reason why she's giving you a lot of shit?
Nope.
She wants you to move.
Nope, she's giving me a lot of shit because I think she has a personality disorder and she can't help herself. So she has a really hard time understanding that I am not separate from her and different. And she won't admit to the emotional abuse that I endured as a kid. So, you know, that's it.
There was I was having a conversation about it. I was like, yeah, that's why I'm this way, Mom. And she was like, did I do? I was like, no, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
No, I mean, yeah, she's...
I kind of got Mark Norman on that.
No, I mean, we're fighting right now because I'm in therapy, and we both think that we want an authentic relationship with each other, but we're so locked into this really terrible pattern that we can't stand to be around each other. So every time she calls, every time I'm near her, I have panic attacks and anxiety stuff. I mean, it's pretty bad. It's pretty, it's bad. So I'm working on that. And then she's doing whatever it is that she's doing. But for right now, it's better if we don't communicate or talk.
But you love her, right?
I don't know what that means in this context, you know? I hate being around her.
I just... You don't like her faults.
If we were not related, we would never spend any time together.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay. We do not... we have a different wavelength. We don't.
And what does Dad do? Is he just like, ugh, I'm just gonna...
Dad stays out of it because he thinks that men and women are a different species of animal, and so he assumes that all of our problems have to do with the fact that we both have uteruses.
Yeah.
He's a military man. We have a great relationship. I love my father.
So you didn't have your vaginas, everything
right.
All right.
I mean, you're like a whole apparatus in your body that's controlled by the moon. I don't get it. I don't want to pretend you're aliens. I don't understand.
That's kind of the dad way.
Yeah.
Dad is just like, your mother? That's how my dad is. Yeah.
So, I mean, and that makes sense up to a point. But I don't know, my dad's my hero. He's always been there for me. One of the primary dynamics, I would say, I moved around a lot as a kid. I was always a new person at school. I got bullied a lot.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I'd come home from being bullied, and my dad was always there to be I think you're great. These kids are wrong. And my mom was more like, well, maybe they have a point. You are sort of a spoiled brat. So, you know,
Jesus.
You're a little bossy, then maybe you should work on that. In retrospect, my mom's not 100% wrong, but it just felt like...
It felt like you could beat my mom for a little
right,
bit.
Right, yeah. I never, ever felt like my mom was on my team. It always felt like she was on this hypothetical stranger's... Mm-hmm. Any way to not be on my team is sort of what it felt like. So.
And so how did you you stayed, put your roots down pretty much in
Raleigh.
Raleigh. What was and you went to College of Charleston, right?
I did. I went to the College of Charleston.
A couple hours away, 3 hours?
So, yeah, it's about 4 hours away.
Is that where they filmed
I don't know. They filmed a lot of things there. They filmed
the Mekhi Phifer, Julia Stiles, Othello.
I don't.
That might be before your time.
I don't know. They did film The Notebook there, and they filmed. It's beautiful. You're probably too young
to remember that. Like 2002, 2003. How old were you? You probably like in high school.
13.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's fine.
Yeah.
I'm old.
It's okay.
No. So would you major in?
I graduated with a degree in history. Mm-hmm. I started off majoring in political science, and I have a minor in theater. Then I immediately worked in politics right after school.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, because you're on your podcast, The Race Wars, with Kurt Metzger and Sherrod Small.
Yes.
You're on that show, you're one of the co-hosts.
Mm-hmm.
And you on that show, you always talk about a lot of, like, your, when they talk politics.
My campaign background.
Yeah, talk about your campaign.
It's a cult, you know, that's
and how you got back into it. How did you get into it from, because it just seemed like you majored in politics, and then you jump right in.
I mean,
right?
I started my political career when I was in middle school.
Okay.
I worked for an organization called Youth Voice Raleigh, mm-hmm. which was this anarcho place. We had like a biweekly radio show, and we published a zine, and we met once a week. And our mission statement basically was: we didn't believe that parents, teachers, and politicians should be speaking on behalf of children who are capable of speaking for themselves.
And what are you, like 12, 13?
Yeah, I was 13 at the time. I was one of the youngest members. A lot of folks. So we would advocate for things like no death penalty for people under the age of 18.
They would give death penalty to mm-hmm. people under.
Yeah, we were one of like six countries left that used to do that. They
Jeez, I didn't even know.
They
that.
Just stopped doing that. We would advocate for medically accurate sex education. We didn't want any of this ideologically driven abstinence only stuff.
Wait, time out. Is this Brita?
No.
Is it?
Oh yes, it is Brita.
It's fucking good.
Oh way, thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's
okay.
Great. It's
continue.
Cool.
Continue abortion.
Yay.
Kids.
Right, so we wanted medically accurate sex education. We wanted we would work with the Food Not Bombs people.
Uh-huh. We're
basically a bunch of, you know, folks that just discovered Karl Marx. Like, so we're, you know,
activist.
Yeah, totally activist. And we would meet, and we had a bunch of white kids with dreadlocks and talk about the man. But the weekly radio show was popular, and we got rid of our zines, and we would steal food from Whole Foods dumpsters and bring them to Food Not Bombs to cook for the homeless. Like, so we'd do stuff like that. From there.
Did you get any brushback from that?
No, not really.
Because you were kids.
We're kids. Like, yeah, it's hard.
Okay.
Yeah, we're kids with parents with lawyers. Like, we felt kind of untouchable.
At least you were doing something productive.
Yeah. We weren't, like, breaking into people's homes and making chaos. Like,
Did they ever catch you at Whole Foods? Mm-mm. Did they ever?
No, but I know that there are locks on the dumpsters now, which I still think is morally repugnant. And I know that Whole Foods is a company in particular that will hire people to like spray pesticide on their garbage to prevent people from using it to feed people that are super poor.
It's crazy.
They'll spend money to prevent you from stealing their trash. Like, that's it.
Because I was just in there on Sunday. Like, I don't go there to buy all of my groceries, but every now and then, I bought myself a steak from there,
mm-hmm.
and as I was walking through, I saw like this, help these this African country
mm-hmm.
and blah blah
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, they're not.
But if somebody that was hungry in the
neighborhood,
you can't fucking. Wow, that's I didn't know they did that.
Well, that's what I would call fringe advocacy. Mm-hmm. So this is a group of people whose core ideology is not acceptable to the mainstream. So we're doing like fringe activism.
Sure.
But they got me hooked up with Planned Parenthood mm-hmm. because that was one of the few organizations that would give medically accurate sex education to anyone that walked in and asked. You know, you could be 12, you don't need your parents, you don't need anything, you just walk in, they'll give you information.
Right.
So I started volunteering for them actually before I lost my virginity to do mainstream political advocacy, because Planned Parenthood, it's a pretty major player. It's not nearly as controversial as like you know, stealing dumpster food and having dreadlocks and mm-hmm. being weird. So I started volunteering for them when I was 15. And pretty soon they figured out that I could walk and talk in front of a camera. And so I was shooting promos for them, and I was speaking in front of like Senate, like state Senate subcommittee hearings. I was doing a lot of fundraising, speaking, a lot of fundraisers, and whatnot. And I got pretty big with them. And so that was one of the reasons I decided to go to the College of Charleston. It's my senior year of high school. I spoke at the fundraising kickoff event to build a clinic in Charleston. And my senior year of college, I went to the ribbon cutting ceremony wow. for that clinic. So I was a big part. Those 4 years, I was president of Vox at the College of Charleston, which is like Planned Parenthood's campus advocacy group.
Now, what is it like doing all those things in the South? Because you, it seems like you would get some kind of resistance.
Yes, absolutely.
Was it like hate mail? Was it people protesting or what?
I feel like if I were a different person, I would have gotten more pushback. But as a cute white girl, the first defense is dismissal. You know, like, but what you don't understand is... but what I also found is that, you know, like Charleston is kind of a blue bubble in a red state. The most pushback I got was from the state Senate. I remember, I don't remember the actual senator's name, but, he basically told me like to sit down, little girl. And I was like, you and your wife are postmenopausal. Like, this is not going to affect you, but like, I'm having sex and that's legal. So, you know.
What did they say when you said that?
I mean, I didn't say that at the subcommittee, but I mean, like, I had a speech prepared, and mm-hmm. he cut me off, basically. Wow. Right, which wasn't...
And you couldn't, like, filibuster?
That's not how that works. No, I'm not. Yeah, that's shit. Not That's not
you
how that works.
You couldn't just say, fucking get me in here?
But we did kill a couple of important pieces of legislation. We got the clinic built, which was great. But so that's what prepared me to do... politics, as I was sort of an activist in high school, middle school, high school, and college.
So that's what you. This issue. So that was your focus.
Yeah, I was going to go to law school. I was gonna work for the ACLU. I was gonna be the baddest thing that ever happened to injustice anywhere in the world.
And how'd your parents feel about that?
Well, my father thought that I was a communist hippie, and my mom thought that I was. On the right page politically, but being exploited by my employer. Because running field campaigns is the boot camp of politics. I mean, it's 120 hours a week for very little pay, and you're trying to do a lot with not a lot of resources.
Fresh out of undergrad?
Yeah.
And what was that like? Because you tell a bunch of... You've told quite a few stories on Race Wars.
I'm so glad that you're a fan of Race Wars.
Yeah, it's a great podcast. Yeah. One of my favorite... new part, right? Because it's relatively new. You guys,
we've been around for about a year.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about like the behind the scenes stuff, like actually trying to incite change. Do you think, like,
So I'll give you an example. I worked for a progressive political consulting firm that I won't name for 2 years. And in those 2 years, I was in 11 cities and I worked on 18, or no, I'm sorry, I was in. I was in 12 cities in 9 states and worked for 11 different clients. Okay. Clients include the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, the ASPCA, you know, the Vote Vets, so like different organizations. And we would run their ground campaign, basically. That's the door knocking and the standing on street corners and the getting people into places. And I did everything. We did fundraising. We did voter persuasion, which is different from... We did get out the vote as well. And then we would do letter writing campaigns to target specific representatives over specific pieces of legislation. So, like, I was in 4 cities in Indiana trying to target Senator Lugar and Senator Bayh, who were both on the National Energy Subcommittee. And then we were trying to get the American Clean Energy and American Jobs Bill out of subcommittee.
Okay.
And so we were in their district, which is the whole state of Indiana because they're state senators, trying to get their constituents to write them letters urging them to vote on this bill and to get it to the floor, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was one. And were you working?
It was in Indiana.
Indiana. Mm-hmm. So how did that happen? Was it just like you were going to Indiana, Caitlin? Or is this like, this is where?
Yeah, I was. I mean, so I was working in New York. They hired me as an assistant director, working in New York, and I did recruitment for them and a bunch of fundraising. So that was mostly Planned Parenthood and the ACLU here in New York.
Okay.
New York was the largest office that we ran. So that was good experience. And the letter writing campaign was the first. That was my promotion to Canvas director. Okay. So that then I was running my own operation. I was the boss, basically for three offices. And so
I at what, 22,
22 years old. Yeah. So they promoted me, without a raise, which is how all promotions happened at this company. It's just more responsibility. You get more of an opportunity to have a greater impact on the causes that you care about. So I packed up all my shit in New York. Thank God I was on sort of a month-to-month situation.
Was this one of your phases where you were in a box for sharing a studio with someone?
I mean, this I was living in a two-bedroom apartment in Spanish Harlem with five people, but we were all working for the same campaign office.
Okay.
So that...
Did they hole you up there? Did they put you...
Yeah, out? Basically, I went to my company and was like, I need help finding housing, and they were like, here
so
you go.
All the other
yes. Drones. This is the box we put people in that can't find an apartment because we don't pay people enough to find an apartment. So then they moved me to Indiana, and I started off in Indianapolis, training with all the other Canvas directors.
Refresh my memory, red or blue state?
I think this is a swing state.
So
but
were you,
they're
were
a
you...
coal they're a coal mining state.
Okay.
That's the problem that we were running into. They're one of the number one employers there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So were you? It seems like you were trying to support the a more.
Blue.
Yeah.
At the time, the American Clean Energy and American Jobs Bill was supported by Lindsey Graham,
mm-hmm.
Who's a Republican from South Carolina. I used to know this shit
sure.
up and down and backwards and forwards. An independent and a Democrat. So
okay.
it was a truly bipartisan bill when it started. During the campaign, we lost Lindsey Graham, the Republican.
Wow,
so
she just...
He.
He.
Yeah. It's fine.
Sorry.
Don't worry about it.
Why did he leave? Just...
Too liberal. It got too liberal.
Okay.
He's one of the original signers of the bill, or one of the original drafters of the bill. That's the weird thing about legislation and working in advocacy, is that the difference between the what we say the bill is... And what the bill becomes is so vast that, like, no one's really talking about what the bill is. Because nobody knows. Like, the negotiation process is so chaotic and last minute, it's hard to know what we're advocating
for. Do they even read them?
I don't know that reading them would be that helpful with the kind of impenetrable legalese that a lot of this is written in.
When I was in... undergrad, I had an internship with a senator, a state senator,
mm-hmm.
and there was just so much, like...
It's nonsense.
It's insane.
Yeah.
The main thing I remember is going to really cool lunches.
Politicians' jobs is fundraising. And that's one of the things that we would do, but we would do grassroots fundraising, which is
mm-hmm.
radically different than, you know, sucking millionaires' dicks, which is a different kind of fundraising.
Yeah, like this, the senator I worked for would get all these, the constituents would come in and they'd
mm-hmm.
try, is he here? We want to spend... yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So did you kind of get disenchanted with it all? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that the first 18 months of the job were great. From Indiana, I went to San Francisco and I ran a fundraising office in San Francisco. From San Francisco, I went to LA and LA had gone through a massive change. So they needed me as a problem solver in LA.
Okay.
So I came in and helped fix the office.
Like a white Olivia Pope?
Basically.
Okay.
They had a systemic fraud problem happening.
Oh.
Because our fundraising, the pay is incentive performance-based. So we had one bad egg that found an algorithm that worked that taught the rest of the office aforementioned algorithm. So we had, like, It was really hard to know. Anyway, I had to fire a bunch of people and get the office started on the right note again, and it was hard. So that was
how old? You were like 23, 24
at this point.
Were you stressed out doing this at all?
I was addicted to Adderall. I didn't have a place to live. At that point, I just stopped buying like frying pans and stuff. That it doesn't make sense to spend $15 to ship a $6 frying pan from New York to Indiana. But after the fourth city that I was at in Indiana, I just stopped buying like the shit that I needed. So because you know I'm not in one place in Indiana. I'm running three offices. Right. So I started off in Indianapolis, and then I had Evansville, Terre Haute, and New Albany that I was running simultaneously. So I had places like so. I'm just living out of my car basically. Then in San Francisco, I get an apartment with my assistant director. But that's only for 2.5 months. And then I'm in LA for 3.5 weeks. But when I get to LA, I don't know how long I'm going to be in LA. So I can't even really sublet from anyone because I just don't know how long I'm going to be there. And I'm in LA, I'm waiting for the call to find out where I'm going to be for the election.
Does that uncertainty freak you out? Because I feel like it would freak me out. Was there
It freaked my parents out.
Yeah.
Who in turn made it their... I'm sorry. It freaked my mom out, who in turn made it her life's mission to freak me out about it. I was pretty comfortable with the whole thing.
Okay.
So for a long time, I thought I was going to Missouri to run the Missouri campaign.
Was this during Obama's first election?
This is 2010.
2010.
These are the midterms.
Okay.
So we're about to get our ass handed to us across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out, instead of going to... Missouri, I ended up in Philadelphia. So I get to Philadelphia and I'm running the Philly office is the plan, but I have to start the Scranton office. Campaign, it's just really hard, you know? Like you have to land in a town you've never been in before GPS. You have to recruit a team of people to work really hard for not a lot of money towards a goal that you spend a lot of energy measuring, which feels really intangible. Like, how many doors did you knock on? How many conversations did you have? How many people said yes to this form? It feels like nonsense, but you have to do all the legal things required for those people, you know?
Right.
And then you have to motivate them to perform at, like, an exceptional level, and then you have to fire them at the end of the campaign. Like, that's the cycle over and over and over again. The 2010 election was hard.
Go back a little bit. What type of people were you hiring?
Transient workers. You're talking about young idealists in college.
And then you just shit on their dreams.
And poor people. Right? That's who we're hiring. Fuck you. I'm sorry.
Fucking phone.
I get it.
Sorry.
It's fine. I forgive you. But that reminds me I should... I have to be somewhere at 7.
Okay, we can wrap it up. To just briefly segue into...
Sure.
Talk about the transition from that to comedy. To talk a little bit about feminism.
Oh, okay. We can... Yeah, no problem.
And we can close it out. You're just ooh, super interesting.
You're awesome. Thank you. The campaign was really hard. The sleep deprivation got really bad. It's difficult to overstate the impact that it can have on your brain and the way that you process things. Like, I remember I had to file a police report because one of the employees that I had to let go gave me a death threat. And so I had to call the police, and they... Jesus. Came to file a report at like a super inconvenient time because everything in the campaign, it's like everything's an emergency all the time. You know, I show up at 6 a.m., I leave at 4 o'clock in the morning, and everything there's no downtime. If you don't get these forms filled out, you can be sued. And if we don't get the canvas out on time, then they're not going to be able to hit the number of doors. And if we don't hit the number of doors, then we can't convince we're going to lose the election. Like, and everything, and the election doesn't move. Like, it's this hard date. Everyone's up your ass, and everything's an emergency in a campaign or in fundraising or in whatever. So I'm doing that. And I remember the police officer asked how old I was, and I couldn't remember. I had to pull my driver's license out of my wallet and hand it to him and let him do the math because I was so scatterbrained and stressed out and sleep deprived. I just couldn't function.
Wow.
I lost my car almost every day. I just couldn't remember where I was parked. I just couldn't.
Jesus.
Like, so everything's falling apart. I end up getting demoted 3 days before the election. So I have a staff of 106 people, and they took the office away from me and gave it to my regional director. I had to take over the office. The other thing that happened during that period of time that's hard to understand for folks that don't work in politics is the polls had shifted. So we went from polling 11 points behind to polling within margin, right? So we get this influx of money.
Margin is good.
Margin is winnable. You can win within margin.
That's
right.
That's what I thought.
So, 11 points out is like, it's over. It's not going to happen. So we moved the polls quite a bit. We did a lot. There were a lot of factors. But
sure.
I was feeling pretty good about my performance. But we got an influx of money. So we had to quadruple the office within 48 hours a week before the election.
Mm-hmm.
When you bring 50 or 60 or 70 new bodies into the office and no one knows where the stapler goes, and you got to move those bodies out to pre-set, mapped out places for them to go knock on doors that no one else has knocked on before, it's a logistical clusterfuck. And that's the point where my sleep deprivation hit me the hardest. And so that's when I blacked out during a recruitment speech. So I'm like talking to a group of new hires about what the plan is as the big boss. You know, the big boss comes in and gives like a speech and then walks out, and all the little bosses come in and like do the other shit. So I was in the middle of that and I blacked out. And I remember I was giving a campaign speech or like getting people excited about what we were going to do as a team. And then the next thing I remember, my assistant director had grabbed my arm. Was standing next to me in the middle of the speech, which is like not something that they're supposed to do. He grabbed my arm and he said, "Hey, Caitlin, come with me. Sarah's got it." And so one of my other assistant directors stepped in my place and started reiterating our talking points. Basically,
did they say what happened?
Yeah,
to you?
I was talking nonsense in a campaign voice. So it was like chickens unite and the furs.
Oh,
and
shit.
I stopped making sense. I literally lost my mind during the campaign.
Wow.
So it's in that context that, you know, my boss comes in and they asked me to stay for another session because they know that campaigns are hard and whatever. But I, at that point I was done. I feel like you can't unsee things. And we were doing things that didn't make sense to me that still in retrospect don't make sense to me. If the goal is like to live in a democracy,
mm-hmm.
I do not believe that we live in a democracy. I do not believe that lobbyists or talking points or the things that are on the news are any reflection at all of what our leaders care about. Or
the
like
views of Caitlin.
It's fine. I mean, I went from being an activist for 10 years to being a non-participant. You know, I don't vote. I watch the news for joke setups. I've released the idea that I can impact change in a positive way or that I know the answer about how to solve big picture social problems.
And then you just got in this, how'd you get to stand up?
I went home, I packed my bags back to Raleigh, back to my
San
parents.
From San Francisco or Indiana?
From Philadelphia.
From Philly. Gotcha.
To study for the LSAT, because I still think that I'm going to go to law school and become a lobbyist
you
and like that. I still thought that at this
point.
Oh,
you still thought that?
I still thought that.
Gotcha.
And so I moved back home, but instead of studying for the LSAT, I ended up putting 3,000 miles a month on my car, chasing stage time all over the state. Wilmington, Asheville, South Carolina.
So it just happened? How did it?
It just happened. I started going to Charlie Goodnight's, and I started getting on stage, and it felt better. I got addicted to that drug.
So was there like a magical moment? You're just like, oh, me and some friends are gonna go. Because I was talking to Carmen Lynch when she mm-hmm. did the show. She just remembered going to a club, just mm-hmm. going out with friends, going to a comedy club she had never been, and then just... What's your moment?
During college, I hooked up with a comic that performed at that college. And while I was running campaigns, I would occasionally, like, because I'm in a lot of different cities, and he's in a lot of different cities, and every once in a blue moon, we'd be in the same city. Yeah. And I'd make a point of seeing him perform, and then we would have sex. And so after I saw his set a handful of times, it lost the magic. I was like, oh, this is a stump speech with jokes. Like, I can do this. This is something that I do already, kind of. And so that...
Explain a stump speech.
Stump speech, like, you know, a candidate goes to eight cities and they're giving the same version. Like, they're giving the same speech over and over again. It's their go-to... it's their go-to speech. I would... What's it called? Anyway. So that took away the psychological barrier that I had to comedy, that it's like this magical ethereal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I had the work ethic because I broke records in Indiana and I ran a, you know, office in San Francisco, and I was crushing at this job. You know, I'd been there for 2 years and I was in charge of a lot.
Can you do stuff with, you still do the pink collar?
That came way later. I started doing comedy in North Carolina, and then this girl that I ended up sharing the studio with reached out to me because she needed money, and she reached out to me and asked me if I was still interested in moving to New York, and made me what I thought was a great offer. It ended up being kind of shitty, but you know, it's what I needed to move here. And then once I got here, I started doing comedy all the time. So that felt great. Here. And now I'm here.
With Parenthood still on pause.
Yeah, Parenthood is still paused.
I want just one more thing. What does feminism mean to you?
I feel like I am less able to answer that question than I ever have been before.
Okay.
I mean, like, you look feminism up in the dictionary, and the definition is that you believe that men and women should have equal rights. And I totally buy that. I really reject a lot of what I would consider benevolent misogyny, which is the idea that women are special, or that women are different, or that women need to be protected. Mm-hmm. Women are like children. Like, all of that stuff, it irks me. I mean, unless someone's paying for dinner, in which case, you know, go fuck yourself. But
so you will let a guy pay for...
Yeah, I mean, I buy into courtship rituals.
Sure, you're from the South.
I'm from the South. Southern girl. And, you know, again, part of our anatomy is controlled by the moon. And that's hard to argue with. Like, it's, you know, I'm more a First Amendment freedom of speech advocate than I am anything else.
Okay.
So... you're never going to hear unequivocally rape jokes are not funny from me. Mm-hmm. But you're also going to get a lot of pushback on the idea that there's something I'm not allowed to say, or that I'm not allowed to do, or that I shouldn't talk about because it's unladylike. That's going to upset me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I reject both of those ideas.
Okay. Because I know, like, the whole Patricia Arquette, like, Oscar acceptance speech, she was kind of like equal wages. And then she's like, all the brown people
as a,
help us out.
As a female stand-up comedian, mm-hmm. I cannot be more thankful that I live in a time where I am not going to be burned at the stake for the things that I say.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's a lot of prejudice against women in comedy. I feel like there's probably more prejudice against women in comedy than there are against women engineers. But I will also say that there's never been a better time to be a female comic, ever. I mean, you know, like, the 80s were harder than they are, than what it's like today. But even on a macro level, thank God I wasn't born in Afghanistan or in the 1800s, because there's no way that I could be as much of my authentic self as I feel like I can be now in this place, in this time, in this country. And I think it's important to not lose that perspective. You know, like, things can be better, and advocacy is important, and all of that jazz. I mean, I dedicated 10 years of my life to it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the grand spectrum of horrific things that could be bad for you, I don't know. I think women in America are kind of nailing it.
Okay. Well, Caitlin.
Yeah.
I think this was great. I want to thank you for letting me hang out with you.
Sure, of course.
And having your amazing filtered water.
No that was problem. Great.
I'd love to talk with you more, but I know we both got to go.
Yeah, we got to go.
But we're busy artists in New York doing our thing. So, Caitlin, thank you very much. Are you going to be anywhere anytime soon? Are you out, like, traveling? Yes. Or
yeah, when is this going to be?
This will go up Sunday.
Okay. Cool. Well, that's exciting.
She's getting her calendar.
Getting my book out. I am performing Sunday at the Laughing Devil in Long Island City at 7 o'clock, and then I'm in Brooklyn at the New York Loft Hostel at 9 p.m. Okay. And then the following week is my big show, March 6th. I produce The Naked Show at the Creek in the Cave.
All right.
So that's March 6th at midnight. So 11:45 for those of you that have fucked up on the calendar. So 11:45 p.m. March 6th.
You're going to get naked.
Along and with a bunch people. Of other people. Yeah.
Okay. And telling jokes.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Stand-up comedy performed in the nude. It's very scary. And I understand the look on your face that tells me that you would never do that. And that's okay.
No. All right, Caitlin. Thanks so much for letting me hang with you.
Great. It was great meeting you.
All right.